If you don't mind, I'd like to introduce myself in the traditional way too. I'm Diné on my mom's side, which is also known as Navajo, but we prefer to be called our real name, which is Diné. And we are indigenous to what is now called New Mexico, Arizona, Colorado, and Utah. And we call it Denetra. So yeah, I'll introduce myself in that traditional way, which involves naming my four clans. So Ya'at'e Shuk'e, which means greetings where sky and earth meet, my kin and my people, because my grandma's taught me all people are your people. And then my first clan is Nanisht'e, which is the Zuni division of the Red Running Into Water clan of the Diné Nation. And I got that from my mother. We're a matrilineal society. Otto Tsetsestese Bashishin. In other words, my father's mother is Cheyenne. And Ashihedeshiche, my mother's father's of the Salt Clan of the Diné. Otto Bilagana, my father's father is of the European clans. So I'm sort of a mixture of things. So in that manner, I present myself as a Diné woman. And I grew up in Taos, New Mexico. I wear a lot of different hats. One of them is I'm a PhD student looking at the intersection of indigenous food systems and indigenous land management practices, which I could nerd out on all day, but I'll spare you all my spiel. And I'm also a musician who accidentally went viral and for the past 4 years prior to COVID was touring pretty much nonstop, trying to spread the message of Indigenous rights through music and poetry, author of a poetry book, Lifting Hearts Off the Ground. Yeah, but I think the things I'm most proud of are more like community organizing and bringing people together to learn Indigenous knowledge the best way that I can and working with my community. So that's sort of who I think I am in a nutshell, but yeah, thanks.
Thank you. So, as you mentioned, you are an incredibly powerful musician and poet. I wanted to hear more about what role the creative arts have played in your own life and what effect you would like your art to have on others. You mentioned the importance of spreading the message of Indigenous rights, but if you could share more on that.
Growing up, I was a native girl who was either like growing up in the BIA schools in Taos Pueblo, where it was all like you had to be native to go to the school. But then my family moved around and I was like usually the only native kid in the whole school. And I like eat lunch by myself every day, like kind of one of those like loner, like, what am I doing in the world type of childhood sometimes. And so I didn't really have a voice, prior to like high school. Like, I had a lot of ideas and I thought maybe they were good, but I wasn't sure. And I knew that I appreciated love and compassion and kindness because I had suffered so deeply as a child. I never wanted anyone else to ever feel like that. So I just had, that's about all I had going for me. And the slam poetry scene was really big when I was a freshman in high school. And one of my good friends, Coral Bernal, brought me to my first poetry slams and she won first place. And I was just like, oh my God, I must do this. So I joined the poetry slam team at the high school. And all of a sudden, this little shy native girl like had a voice and people liked it. And it was usually pretty powerful. I don't even know why I didn't even try, but I think what I was saying and how I was saying it was really impacting people. And so I started doing, winning national poetry slams and got into Stanford because of my poetry and my GPA, but mostly my poetry. And from there, kept staying on the poetry slam team. And that slowly turned into music. It's a natural evolution because as poets, we're lyricists and we have messages. So a lot of my music, I play guitar and piano and flute and mouth harp and whatever else, beat machines, whatever I can make a sound with. When you put the message of a poet over those musical instruments, it hits people in a whole nother way. So I guess to answer your question, for me, the creative arts have only ever been useful to the extent that they can spread the message of love, ultimately. And love takes many forms, including Indigenous rights. But to me, art is only useful or helpful or desirable to the extent that it spreads the message of love.
Drawing on that, I would like to learn more about your perspective on the role and impact of the creative arts in movement spaces for environmental and social justice. How would you describe their role and impact?
Well, I think that I used to wear this t-shirt that I got from a poetry slam, and it said, "The role of the revolutionary artist is to make the revolution irresistible." And I believe that was Assata Shakur's quote. And I think that is really part of it, you know, that we are here to not just talk about the movement intellectually, but help people feel it in their bones and in their soul, like a message they can dance to and get out of their heads intellectually about it and get into their heart. When you hear a poem that is talking about someone's personal experience with incarceration of people of color, and it's no longer just a statistic or a issue that politicians can debate about. It's like, here's a real person who's really been through it, and they're speaking from their heart about this really viscerally painful experience, and people connect to that on a whole different level. So growing up in the slam poetry scene, I was very used to that. It's like, yeah, we move each other. We move each other deeply, and we inspire each other, and we help people bring these quote unquote issues out of the abstract intellectual realm and deep into our hearts so that we feel it and we know it in a different way. And I think that's the power of art, the power of music, power of graphic design, the power of videography, all these different art forms, is they get people out of their heads and connecting with these, again, quote unquote issues on a personal, heartfelt level. And that's where I think real change happens.
In an article that you wrote for the Esperanza Project, although that was speaking about food, you emphasized that it's not just what we do, but why we do it. Do you think that comes out through the creative arts of, as you said, bringing these issues and conversations into the heart, almost redefining expertise in a way of, it's not just the statistics and facts, but it's making it emotional, making it intimate, making it personal?
Yeah, I mean, how we do things and why we do things is often overlooked in American society, where it's all about what. It's about quantity and how much of it, and how quickly did it happen. And in Indigenous communities, a lot of it is more about how you go about it, and the process is more important than the outcome. Like Standing Rock, for example, the outcome is that we quote unquote lost because the Dakota Access Pipeline did go under the Missouri River and is transporting crude oil across the country. So in that sense, we quote unquote lost. But my elders, some of the elders I talked to, encouraged me to reframe it as actually we won, because it was the process by which we fought was valiant, virtuous, grounded, prayerful, deep, and it undoubtedly changed the world and every single person who stepped foot on that camp, including the police, who were macing us and rubber bulleting us and sticking dogs on us and all the stuff just for trying to protect water. And so I think it's about why we do things and how we do things. Like, for instance, you could do a really beautiful video about, you know, missing and murdered Indigenous women. But if the reason why you're doing it is to gain popularity and reputation in your community, that makes it kind of, people will feel that, you know, but if the reason why you're doing it is because you really genuinely are trying to save even one woman from getting kidnapped from her indigenous community, which happens all the darn time for, you know, the sex trafficking industry, then that's a different why, right? That's a different reason why. Your reason is you want to help others. And so I think, and then you get into the how, which is important, is like, maybe you're doing it with a good heart, but are you doing it in a way that judges others or shames others or pressures others or intimidates others to get this virtuous outcome that you want? And that isn't quite the way either, you know, in my opinion. You want to do it in a way that is uplifting everything around you, ideally. So, you know, none of us are perfect. We all do things differently. We all have different opinions on how, but to at least have some care and caution and premeditation about the why and the how of what you do, if that makes sense.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. And going back to your introduction and how you emphasized in your life the importance of community organizing and drawing these conversations together, would you say that the value of community organizing is a part of this why and how, that when you're working within your intimate kin relationships of it's this landscape is where I was born, or I'm working with my neighbors and my own family, you get more of that why and how out of it compared to within social and environmental justice? There's sometimes this notion within Euro-American societies of we have to go out to make a difference, but sometimes it's about coming in. Would you?
Yeah, I think a lot, or not just a lot, happens on the community level, but maybe even anything worth happening happens on a community level. And here's why, is that if the people themselves are not dictating their own solutions, it's always going to be a temporary fix. It's always going to mismatch what the community really wants. And I think in American society, we have really normalized top-down solution approaches where the government decides in Congress or in state-level governments or even city councils, this is what we're going to do. And we get to say what we're going to do because you elected us last year. And so therefore we get to decide. And then everyone just kind of has to deal with it, whatever that is. And to some extent, you know, leadership is necessary. But at the same time, a lot of indigenous communities back in the day were decentralized governmental structures in the sense that even down to the family level, there was sovereignty of what that family would choose to do, where they would be, et cetera. And it was only very recently that the Navajo Nation was formed, this formalized, centralized government. And that centralization of our Diné people decision-making process has really harmed us, because then all oil companies need to do is bribe and distort those key leaders, and then it has control over the whole population. And that's actually why they created the Navajo Nation government. In the Constitution, it says the reason for the creation of this government is to facilitate the exportation of quote-unquote natural resources from these homelands. So when you get to the community level, on the other hand, and you ask people, if you could have anything you want, what would it be? You know, that is such a powerful question. And that's actually what I wrote my master's thesis on in the College of Education at University of New Mexico, which was, hey, let's all make a summer school. And if you wanted to teach and learn anything, what would it be? And people have been so disempowered, and nobody asks them these questions for so long that sometimes we don't even know what to say if someone would ask us that. Like, I don't know, the president's supposed to figure it out, or the mayor, or the governor, when actually we are most suited to determine what should go on in our communities because we're the ones who live there. And yeah, we might make mistakes, but that's also good because we learn from mistakes and we refine. So I think community, like you said, looking inward for community creation. I mean, I've only done it once in a really deep, intentional way, and it was beautiful. I mean, we had over 200 Diné people come together and build their own school. And it was super popular. Everyone loved it. Everyone had, like, because it was made by the people. So of course everyone came because it reflected the hearts and the dreams of the people. And I think that's a really important process for any solution building we create.
On these comments about the consolidation of power and how a centralized government can be used then informs as a weapon against the power of the people, I'm curious if you think that the relations to land play into that as well, and the settler logic of private property and the consolidation and individualization of that, how it has also been a way to consolidate and dispossess people of power and challenging the communal relations to the land and thus the communal relations between the people.
Wow, that is a very deep question that I never really connected the dots between the institution of private property and the centralization of power. You know, it's interesting you say that because in a way, private property decentralized power because everyone has their own little plot of land and they get to decide. But that form of decentralizing power has the opposite effect of what I'm talking about of decentralized government. Because even though it's decentralized and you have all these different people owning little plots, you lack the holistic, cohesive, connected nature of an ecosystem. Like, for example, the Chesapeake Bay, you know, Virginia, Maryland, what we now call Virginia, Maryland, had 10,000-year-old oyster fishery that the Algonquin nations harvested oysters, ate them, deposited them in these shell piles, ancient shell piles that we can look at, archaeologists can look at and measure. Wow, Algonquin peoples ate oysters out of this bay for 10,000 years sustainably. And not only that, but the shells actually got bigger over time, meaning they enhanced and augmented this food supply. And all the early explorers would marvel. They'd be like, wow, I have to like cut this oyster into thirds just to fit it in my mouth because they were so much bigger than the ones in Britain. And then today there's almost no oysters left in the Chesapeake Bay. It has almost completely collapsed within just 300 years of American mismanagement. The oyster population, everyone's like, oh my God, how do we save the oysters? How do we save the oysters? And it's so simple. It's the farmers upstream who have their private little lots, who just have their own little siloed universes that they don't have to be accountable to bigger systems that they're connected to. They bring all these fertilizers into the soil and those run into the rivers, which runs into the bay, which creates these pH levels in the bay that are not good for the oysters. And then meanwhile, the oyster fishermen, the American oyster fishermen, are dredging the bottom of the bay and just scratching the whole oyster bed out of existence to extract as much oysters as possible because they don't have to be accountable to future generations who are going to need oysters. So this whole siloing ourselves in space and time that, well, I have my little private property. So whatever happens outside of my fence line, my property line, my boundary line, I don't care. I don't care what happens out there. And I don't care how what I do here affects what happens out there. And you get what we have now is just all of the rivers are full of fertilizer. You know, these farmers are just destroying whole watersheds. Also, they're isolated in time, right? It's like they're not just thinking, I don't care what happens out of my property line. They're thinking, I don't care what happens out of my time. I don't care what happens next generation, two generations, because I'm focused on how many profits I can make in the next fiscal quarter. So we need to, instead of decentralizing that. And I think we kind of need to centralize that, of not centralize it, but connect it, create these connections of like, hey, all y'all in the, let's say, for example, the McLeod River Basin in California, you all are pretending like you're separate, but everything you do affects one another. And how do we work together on a watershed basis? That will be the next evolution of humanity on this continent.
Thank you for sharing that. And I hear what you brought up of going back again to this, why we do it, and this in Euro-American perceptions of it's for personal benefit, and all costs are perceived again on that personal level of if it affects someone outside of myself, whether it's the more than humans, the landscape, the community down the stream, that's not understood as a personal cost. So reframing and understanding that the personal is a part of the collective reframes what is a benefit and what is a cost.
Yeah, and that's why the lack of private property, I mean, not all, some indigenous nations definitely did fall into the trap of private property, but they usually learned really fast that doesn't work. But, you know, that's why this imposition of private property has really shortchanged us, and we've lost out as humanity, because when we're not operating on holistic systems levels, we're not tapping into the forces of nature. We're not tapping into the larger forces at hand that could feed us really easily if we just work together, and not only feed us, but feed the whole system, the biodiverse system.
Speaking on this point of food and the importance of food systems and agriculture, I mentioned it before, but in an article for the Esperanza Project, a green magazine for the Americas, you shared about your personal journey with food and agriculture. You brought it up that it's a lot of what you're thinking about now with your academic program. Would you share some reflections on who you have learned from, as well as what you have learned through your own journey?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I never thought I would go into food. And even the word food is funny, because it turns this dynamic process of energy exchange into a noun, like a discrete noun. I interviewed 4 indigenous elders. Well, one was a young man. And I said, how do you say food in your language? And they were all verb based. They weren't nouns. They were verbs that had a little suffix on the end that turned it into a noun. Because to us, food is a process, kind of like I said, with process versus outcome. It's a process, and how you do that process and why you do that process. But in any case, food, I don't know how I got into that. One of my elders, gosh, this was about 5 years ago, he said something that will always ring in my heart. And he said, indigenous peoples control enough land to change the way the world thinks about food and water. And we don't have very much land holdings, but what we do have, we can show people how to live on this land. And he also sort of foreshadowed some of our prophecies, you know, which are found throughout this continent from Native communities, that like, it's gonna get really bad really soon. And people aren't gonna have water the way we are used to, where we just turn on the faucet. People aren't going to have food the way we're used to, where you could just waltz into Whole Foods or Publix or whatever and just buy whatever you want. We're running out of bullets in the agricultural industry, where these monocrops and these large pig farms, cow farms, they depend on vaccines and antibiotics, because those diseases love thousands of pigs in one spot. It's like, oh, cool, I can just rip through this whole population. You know, that's why biodiverse forests don't have diseases like that, because there's no one virus that can hack everything. But in a pig farm, it just takes one virus that can hack that pig's DNA, and it is good to go, and it just rips through the whole thing. So monoculture and mono animal settings are sort of like a virus's paradise. And moreover, not only do we have just one species in one place, but we are like cloning these species. So their genetic diversity is very thin. So this elder was explaining this to me, and he was basically like, we are so screwed. And I know you're not a food person, Lilo. He didn't say that, but in my mind, I'm thinking that. But if you could become one, that would be really good, because we're going to need help soon. And it was sort of a grave conversation, you know, and it was like, okay, this is real. And I was thinking of doing a PhD, and I was like, I don't want to do a PhD unless I really, really, really love the topic. And it's something I know I would do even if I wasn't getting a PhD in it. And that was food. And so I'm 3 years into the program. I'm about 1 year away from getting the degree. I'm nerding out. I'm loving it. And some of the things I've learned is that, you know, it would take a while to explain, but I just wrote a paper on indigenous fisheries, 6 case studies that were all at least 6,000 years old, demonstrating the practices of indigenous peoples in sustaining these fisheries. I also wrote a paper recently on fire and how native peoples have burned every square mile of this continent. We do so in the fall, in the dormant season, when the grasses have kind of died and gone dormant. We burn that off and bring those ashes into the soil, which actually creates these nutrient-dense soil systems, and how the exclusion and prohibition of indigenous fire in the late 1800s has pretty much created chaos in all these ecosystems, which were pyro-adapted. These specific species had co-evolved with human fire. Low-intensity burns, you know, people get scared of fire. They're like, oh my God. No, I'm talking low-intensity, very meticulous, even ceremonial fires that would sort of clear the land, cleanse the land, bring the ashes in, eliminate competing vegetation from the old growth, nut trees, fruit trees, etc. And that happened rhythmically for thousands of years. And so all of these species in what we now call America are pyro-adapted, and they don't have any fire. So it's getting crowded out by blah, 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 you know, woody species and all these things that are encroaching on ancient indigenous habitats. So, okay, that was one paper. The third paper I wrote was on soil management and really looking at indigenous soil management systems, specifically looking at Ashiwi or Zuni Pueblo runoff agriculture, which taps into the watersheds. And, you know, they plant their fields at the bases of watersheds, which is so revolutionary, but, you know, to them was like a no-brainer. And so they do this dry land desert agriculture that harnesses the forces around them to create really rich, loamy, nutrient-dense soils that they then grow blue corn in the middle of the desert every season with no problem.
I think this comment that you wrote in the article ties into this conversation. You said, quote, here we are with our fancy technology and we can't even close the wealth gap disparity. All of our PhDs going to the moon and we can't even keep our oceans clean. So we have all this knowledge, but we have no wisdom. I would like to hear more about this perspective of the difference between knowledge and wisdom, and through your own work as a student and learning how you've understood this difference and the importance of moving towards acknowledging wisdom over knowledge.
Yeah. Well, wisdom comes from experience, right? And we are still learning as a species. I would argue that Native nations had experienced so much here that we learned what doesn't work. We had caste systems here. We had slavery here. We had huge cities here. The Mayan civilizations, the Chacoan civilizations, the mound building civilization. I mean, we were like New York City all over the place. Dense, dense populations, but they became arrogant. They had hubris. And every single time, Creator kind of smacked them down. That's not the way you live on my creation. You be humble. And so we learned the wisdom we have the hard way, you know, through collapse, through hurting each other, hurting ourselves. And a lot of our wisdom as indigenous peoples is hard earned. And I think in Europe, gosh, they just got their butts kicked. I mean, torture chambers, women getting burned alive, women drowning alive, Roman expansion, Inquisition, British destruction of Welsh, Gaelic, and Celtic language systems. I mean, it was full out dog eat dog at a certain point when originally they had been goddess cultures, you know, they had been earth connected cultures. And so all of that wisdom was intentionally eradicated. And then all these European folks, what are they supposed to draw on? All they know is war for the past 2,000 years or more, 3,000. There's a great book called Chalice and the Blade, which sort of chronicles archaeologically the shift from what she calls a chalice culture or a culture of abundance and sharing and community to a blade culture, which is a culture of fortification and defense and war in Europe. And that lack of wisdom, that, and I don't just blame humanity. I think there is what we call coyote, or some nations call it spider, but this trickster spirit that is always messing with us. You know, like we're not just alone in our faults and our follies. There is, in my opinion, and people surely will disagree, a real force in this world that is constantly, it hates creator, but it can't hurt creator. So it hurts the next best thing, which is creation. And we're a part of creation. And it harms us very deeply in many ways. And so the wisdom traditions of Europe were pretty much dilapidated by the time Columbus came over here. And again, systematically eradicated wisdom cultures in this continent almost completely. We're talking 98% of indigenous peoples getting wiped out by disease and massacre and starvation and just heartbreak. And so, anyways, I think despite our current situation having a dearth of wisdom in our American culture, we innately and inherently have this thing in our bones called love and compassion and kindness. And even with all of the greatest assaults on our humanity, somehow that core of what we are doesn't get extinguished. And I don't know how, but somehow we manage to tap into that kindness and reach out to each other. And the children, every passing generation, seems to call out the lies one by one and bring us closer to our truest nature, which is that of compassion and kindness. And so I think despite us having a lack of cultural structures that teach us wisdom, that innate, inherent wisdom that every child is born with, and some get to hold on to even through all the trauma they experience as children growing up, that is something that will always be there. And that is the seed that we can always plant and cultivate and protect and will eventually help us.
In this conversation, do you feel that a part of it is how Euro-American societies teach knowledge and this notion of the scientific method and objectivity and removing humanity from our perceptions and understandings of the world that there almost needs to be a redefining or reimagining of knowledge and wisdom to bring ourselves back into it to promote emotional relationship and personal intimate connection into our knowledge systems rather than, I feel our knowledge, Euro-American knowledge, reinforces this human nature mind-body divide in the way it teaches.
Absolutely. I mean, kind of like I was saying in the Esperanza article, how could we have so many PhDs and yet have so much human trafficking? How could we have all this technology to go to the moon, but we can't even save the salmon? How do we have all of these experts and institutions and yet, you know, so much of our population is living in poverty? And I think that alone sort of, you know, they say the proof is in the pudding. if our education systems worked, arguably, you know, we wouldn't be where we are. So there's that, you know, the pudding sort of speaks for itself. But beyond that, sort of digging into what you're saying a little more deeply, I mean, I went to Stanford. I always say that I went to Stanford, you know, but I did. And it was just such a funny experience. I didn't understand what they were talking about because I came from an ontology and an education system that was deeply rooted in community and prayer. The sweat lodge, the Sundance, all of these ceremonies, the blessing way, they are where I learned education. The kinalta, you know, the womanhood ceremonies. That to me made so much more sense than my economics class at Stanford, who said, our primary assumption is that everyone will be up for themselves and that there's not enough. That's literally the two foundational assumptions of modern economics. Everyone's out for themselves and there's not enough. And they say that on page one of Econ 101 at Stanford University. And that just did not make sense to me. So it's not just the Cartesian, Descartes sort of mind-heart split, which is important, where, you know, they're all about the intellect and what can you see and does it measure, is it measurable? And that is an issue. But in addition to that, sort of the primary disciplines that teach us how to live, which is like economics, even anthropology being highly colonial and depicting everyone on this spectrum of primitive versus civilized. Anyways, I could go on about that. But these basic blueprints that these universities are handing to these children, basically, of how to live are very fundamentally flawed and inaccurate, in my opinion. I don't think everyone's out for themselves, unless that's the social agreement we all come to, but it doesn't have to be the social agreement. I don't think there's not enough for everyone. I think this planet is by design a planet of abundance. And if we work together, to your point, and work on a holistic regional level, we're all going to be better off for it. So yeah, there's a lot to say about the Eurocentric education system and how it is definitely a part of the problem. And I could go on and on, but mm-hmm. I think the core thing is that it's just not serving us at the end of the day. And that's pretty evident all around us.
Also, speaking of your American knowledge systems and what we're taught to know within these different institutions, in regard to the environmental sciences, I feel that it's often all despair and hopelessness, and really reinforcing that humans are a bad mix within the natural world. If you want to preserve, you have to have, you know, that notion of the wild that's so violent in and of itself, that there is this natural world and it ideal and perfect without humanity. And going back to the article you wrote, that quote, human beings are meant to be a gift to the land. And you shared the wisdom of an elder who said, quote, in our language, the word for human means chosen one. We are called chosen ones because we are chosen by Creator to take care of the earth. We are the chosen species to steward her. Will you speak more to what this means to you, to be a gift to the land, to embrace the role as stewards of the earth?
Yeah. And that elder, by the way, was a Yoruba elder speaking at the Parliament of World Religions in Toronto. So it's a Yoruba concept from West Africa. Yeah, I mean, I had the pleasure of learning from my classmate, Vina Brown, who is from Bella Bella, British Columbia. And she talks about her people's kelp forests and how they hand plant kelp forests along the coastline, and how this increases the surface area for the herring to spawn and lay their eggs, which they do by the probably billions. This, the whole coastline turns like a milky white, and it's just a huge injection of calories and protein for the whole wet, food web. And so they've been doing this for thousands of years, and it's really cool how they single-handedly with their hands alter the ecosystem by planting these kelp forests. They plant them both on like rocks and tie them to ropes. These are kelp that grow really fast. Sometimes they'd even put boughs of hemlock and cedar into the coastline waters by weighting those down with rocks and tying the trunks to the logs that would float on top. And so they would have like these upside down trees in the coastline all over in the water, sort of collecting all this herring roe. And so that was just one example of many where these people actually enhance, in her words, she said, "Lila, we can't just sustain the land. We need to enhance the land." And I think that's an indigenous ethic, is like, we don't want to just settle for being sustainable. We want to be enhancers, feeders, contributors to these systems. And if the Heiltsuk Nation, which is her nation from Bella Bella, if they were to disappear, I mean, the system would suffer. And that's what I mean by humans are meant to be a gift to the land. Like, we could be so good to her that if we were to leave, she would miss us. And I think that this is important because we are always framed as misfits of creation. We're always framed as these mistakes, these problem children species on the planet. And I think we actually have the power to be nourishers of our mother. And I think that's something that would be good to teach our children, instead of like, oh, if humans were gone, everything would be better, you know? And so we have to prove that, though. And that's what I'm doing with this PhD, is I'm trying to give people concrete examples. And Heiltsuk is just one of very many, which I could launch into, but I will spare you. Very many examples of different indigenous nations really upholding whole ecosystems as a keystone species, as a linchpin of the whole combination of processes. And by giving people these concrete examples and proving it to people, that's when I think people will really start listening to us. Because it's one thing to wax philosophical and be theoretical armchair theorists, but to really show the world these different nations and how they operate is, I think, where we're going to change some minds.
For those who do not yet fulfill this role, what do you see as the path to becoming a gift to the land? Of course, you're mentioning the importance of concrete examples, but really understanding how you see that path forward. Perhaps it's not an end goal, but rather, as you are emphasizing, that it's constantly a process of we'll be working for this as long as we are a part of the earth.
Yeah. Well, I think one thing that all settler society can do is get behind the leadership of indigenous traditional ecological knowledge holders, and to really listen more than we speak in terms of settler society, because we, and I'm half European almost, so I say we, we have a lot to learn from indigenous peoples. And we can, yes, we need to go back to the land, but we also need to give land back to native people. And once they have land bases where they can actually do this communal ecological management practices, then we can kind of fall in line and do what our ancestors originally planned, which was to be hospitable to these guests from Europe and bring them in a way that was respectful to our communities and our expertise. It's not like, well, some might disagree with me, but it's not like we want all Europeans to disappear and go away. We just want Europeans to be humble and to recognize they're on someone else's homeland, and to listen more than they speak, and observe and learn how to walk in a gentle way on this very precious earth. So anyways, that's one thing. Basically, listen, observe, support, ask Native communities, how can I help, if at all? And secondly, you know, I think if you do own land, for example, or maybe you're an urbanite, you know, and I think that's probably part of our healing will be to be more connected to where our food comes from, where our water comes from, no matter where you live. And if that means moving from the city and going somewhere where you have a little bit of land to be with, you know, I think that could be good too. And I think also getting, supporting these species like churro sheep, even certain rare species of goats, rare species of, you know, for instance, buffalo. But if we could all become caretakers of these species, it evolves us as humans to take care of animals. That daily constant, anyone who has a dog or a cat can attest, like that daily constant service to life grows mm-hmm. us. And so I think this might sound funny, but I think one step is for all of us to get some churro sheep or some buffalo, like, you know, or at least support someone who has those and become in relationship with these food animals, which are not just food, but they're our relatives. They're people in their own right. So that's a funny recommendation to, like, you know, get some livestock. But and of course, there's all these instructions on how to do that in a good way. But anyways, I think being in more community and connection with life in general.
I want to be respectful of your time. So I just wanted to ask if there was anything more you wanted. Okay. If there was anything more that you wanted to share, I will give you that space.
Oh, thank you so much, Anna. I think my main message is to just, it's going to sound silly, but to love yourself the best you can and to love others the best you can, which is no small task in today's world where we have made so many mistakes and we do carry so much shame. And we do carry so many memories that we wish we didn't carry. Or, you know, it's hard to find someone who truly loves themselves through and through. And to, on one hand, be accountable for our mistakes, and on the other hand, be forgiving of each other and help each other have a path forward to their own rehabilitation and not writing each other off as lost causes, but to have hope in each other, in ourselves, and to always pray for support in that personal healing, that personal development, and to pray for the same for others and be on the side of each other, be on the side of one another so that we could really help each other flourish, or at the very least improve and be better than we were yesterday. And I think that's really important in a society where we do have so many differences and we do have such a painful, gruesome history. How do we ever move forward from something like that, from slavery, from genocide, which was born from other forms of slavery and other forms of torture back in Europe and other places? How do we ever give each other a second chance and a third chance and a fourth chance and a fifth chance and a sixth chance and a seventh chance? You know, how do we help each other along this path? I think that's something that's on my mind most these days, is how do we not only give each other second chances, but give ourselves second chances and be gentle with ourselves as we hold ourselves accountable, be gentle with ourselves as we take responsibility for our effect on this planet and on each other, and to be merciful with each other and with ourselves, rather than harsh and impatient and judgmental and ready to write each other off so quickly. So in any case, that's sort of a deeper underlying process underneath everything we're talking about. And it's not complete without forgiveness, And it's also not complete without accountability and responsibility. So holding those two apparently disparate opposite things in both hands, you know, it's like, doesn't seem like you could hold them both at once, but I really think you can. And I think that this whole podcast is an expression of that in so many beautiful ways. And I'm honored to be a part of it.
Thank you so much for that reflection and for holding this space with me and giving me the opportunity to learn from you. And I think that was such a beautiful, beautiful way to end, especially with your introduction of bringing the wisdom of your own elder saying all people are your people. I really felt that in these final reflections. So I really appreciate you taking the time and sharing your gifts of knowledge and wisdom with me today. Deeply appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much. Appreciate it too.